just to me to deviate from my routine, instead of continuing this evening with Baruch Hablosim, to say something with regard to Purim. This Shabbos in Yerushalayim will experience Kiyum Moshe Vedershi, Shabbos, Purim Shabbos B'Shabbos. So that's to some extent, instead of the Megillah, which one doesn't read then, this evening is not instead of the Megillah, it's about the Megillah. Or to do yourself to what central aspect, although of course there are many, many more that could be dealt with. In Chazal, the term that said generally used for what we call the Megillah is simply the Megillah. Occurs in Megillah. Maseches Megillah is about Megillah. Says not about the others. To the extent that we specify, though, describe it, define it, describe it in some greater detail, we rarely refer to it as Megillah at this stage. So we might ask ourselves just why the identification of the Megillah with Esther particularly more than the others, why the Mordechai, etc. I suppose there's several reasons. One is for her role, which Chazal speak of, in assuring the place of the narrative and of Megillah as such as part of Kisvei HaKodesh. One says in Megillah that she asked first, Kisvuni Ladoos, Kivuni Ladoos, that a place of permanence should be found for the narrative, for whatever lessons could be learned therefrom, and that Chachma Adair responded possibly, and not only does Megillah have that kind of status, but in certain respects, the Rambam says at the end of Chassam Megillah that Lassi Lavoi, that all of Megillah, Chamish Mushetel, will survive. Megillah itself, of course, the writing of described to her primarily with the Ketuv Estel Malkabat, Esther Malkar, Mechabed Rechai, etc. Esther Malkar, and it's described to her, she's mentioned first. The Ramban notes in other contexts where two people are mentioned together, they're not listed in the plural, the one who's mentioned first, the one who's the most involved and the most central figure. Debir B'Yav Aron Moshe, Parshat Baris, in the context. Here, if it's a Tikhtov Esther feminine, obviously she's the one who's most prominent. Another plane, of course, she is, if we will, the central character of the narrative. But I think this additional factor play, why it's identified with her as opposed to Mordechai. Suddenly the role which she fulfills, but the process which she undergoes. Granted, to everyone else in the Megillah, not very much happens to them. Well, in one respect, of course, such an event does not go unnoticed and leaves an imprint. But at the personal plane, as far as one can tell, whatever Mordechai is at the beginning, that's pretty much what he is at the end. The other characters don't interest us particularly. But certainly the difference between the Esther of the beginning of the Megillah, Esther of the end of the Megillah, is incomparably greater than that of Mordechai at the beginning and Mordechai at the end. The development, and it's a story of a growth and development at a personal plane, is at various levels. To one level, there's still the question as to whether, to what extent, there is a process of maturation at a sort of a psychological level. There's an interesting machlokes in the Medrash, it's one startling Medrash, it's one of the days startling. So whether she was a young girl or an old woman, in fact. One day there, she was in her 70s. It is very, very strike, very unusual, and it seems to run in the face. Sukim, Narot, Tulot, Tavot Marer. And I imagine that we have very difficult in a set country of view, and instinctively, without looking further, assume that we're dealing with a young girl. The process which she undergoes, or the process of maturation, is one which, of course, is not just the normal process for the year, 2 years, as long as it took, but one of growth, personally, psychologically, as I mentioned before, maturity. When she first appears on the scene, it's emphasized as her passivity. She has almost no will of her own. She's very flexible. And this in various planes. At one, from our point of view, of course, relatively less significance, with regard to what happens in the second parak, once she's called and she waits her turn until she'll appear before the king. So everyone else has certain demands and certain, which cosmetics of this kind or that kind. And with regard to her, nothing. Whatever Shashka Sisa Malach says, that's what she expects. Passive even with regard to something, an area in which choice is given. Every other young woman who comes says she wants this, she wants that. Here, whatever Shashka says, that's good enough for her. Of course, another level, a much more significant one, the relationship to Mordechai, but it's also one which emphasizes the total passivity and being subject to his will. This presumably is the situation in which he first appears on the scene. She's under his wing, so to speak. We omitted that it says about Dodo. But some says in the Pesukim later on is that even after she's taken to the royal palace, presumably a position of prominence, and one which is beyond prominence, which is Mordechai, her mentor, same thing. We notice the pasuk is divided into two sections. One is specifically, she follows Mordechai's orders not to reveal her identity, her origin. But that, of course, has a clear reason, a very pragmatic reason. This is not necessarily an indication of total subjugation, but it might be dangerous. And but it's, well, for the moment, Haman and the likes, his likes, and not telling the prowl, but the danger they'll be there. Apparently, that Mordechai smells this out. Therefore, he says, better than not to reveal her identity. But second of the passage, then this goes on to stress, it's not simply wise counsel to which she adheres in a situation of stress and crisis. But this is what defines the relationship. There's no initiative, there's no originality, no self-expression, none of the kind of things that we normally expect in an adolescent girl or a young woman, and particularly one that's been transitioned to prominence to want to develop, particularly in a community. We will, one might also say whim, is a central factor. That's the point of departure. Of course, things change, and change radically. what is the heart of the Megillah? Primarily the fourth parak. Or to some extent the fifth. The initiative there initially is taken, of course, by Mordechai, tells everything that happened, and sends a message. The response is, again, the same passivity. She can't do anything, she can't take any chances. This is her response. It's what we would expect of the Esther we've known previously. But what happens is, a moment of crisis and somewhat of the pressure of Mordechai's importunity, she begins to take hold of the situation, she begins to reveal some capacity for initiative. Mordechai takes her to task. This kind of passivity, it's unthinkable. And then comes the turning point as far as the relationship is concerned. Instead of her responding and taking orders from him, I told myself, Shiva Mordechai, it's much more than a response. All of a sudden, who is giving orders and who is responding with and implementing the orders, all of this changes. Keep thinking about this connection, of course, like Knos Kalevudin and Simba Shushan. This is not something which she had asked of her. He had told her simply go talk to the Melech, and the Esther we'd seen until now, presumably either said yes or said no, probably said yes. But her fear restrains her, and instead she said, I can't do that. He then pressures her, and then for the first time in the Megillah, she takes charge. And takes charge not only on an interpersonal plane, the relationship between herself and Mordechai, but a position of leadership. He is to implement, but it's her idea and her initiative. And then remarkably in the following pasuk, Yavon Mordechai, Vayas Kichol, Ashat Sivitala Vester. She's all of a sudden a mitzvah, she gives orders, tells him what to do. And there you have, of course, a complete reversal of roles, a reflection of the maturity which she's attained. To some extent, I suppose, it's a question of time, to some extent, the exposure to the royal court, the sophistication which goes with that, to some extent, the exposure to the more cosmopolitan environment. Shushan, this is the capital city, Me'ava Shushan Medina. And all of that has some impact. Part of it has to do, of course, with the pressure of circumstance, the response being challenged. So the ability to take charge, this is part of the process of her own growth and her own development. But the capacity and the ability has to do with one's psychological constitution. In that respect, unquestionably, it was a great leap forward from the first part to the fifth. But there was an additional element, rather two additional elements. It's not a question of whether one is able, what one wants. And the shift in this respect is likewise significant. A shift which is partly within Esther herself, but partly her impact upon the community and the direction which she tries to move it. The There is a moral element here, and there's also a religious element. The moral element has to do with the transcendence of the concern about oneself and the assumption of responsibility for a community, for a nation, for those in danger, even when one personally could get away with it. Shushan as a whole is a community, culture, is what's described in the Megillah, in which the concern for others, the welfare of others, is, to say the least, a very minor key. It's a very individualistic kind of culture, symbolized perhaps by Asokin Sonish Vaish. Chazal were somewhat critical of this. They had discussions whether he was a wise man or a foolish man. And those who said it was Melech Tipesh said, well, Asokin Sonish Vaish, one assumed that would be possible. This was a matter of folly. But leaving aside whether it's wise or foolish, what do we think about this in terms of the moral categories, in ethical terms? The Shushan, which is described to us, is one within which there's a lot of intrigue and tension, but which fundamentally is an awful lot of moral corruption. The tonal step to this was, of course, the very beginning of the Megillah. Half year of this wondrous feast, topped off by the week which you have at the end, all of this opulence, all this attention to externals. And all of this, of course, at a cost, an enormous cost, all the people out there, Me'av Eskushev Medina, all of the peons, the Falchid, who within what probably prepared a feudal context, are suffering and laboring in order to enable all of this wealth and all of this opulence, this magnificence to be displayed. And I said, Tzunish Vaish means that there's a certain class, elitist aristocracy, within a capital city, by nature cosmopolitan and affluent, as opposed to the provinces, which are always much more conservative in nature and character. And here, Lasot Tzarish Vaish is done, in order that one should in Shusha be able to look at Tzarish Vaish, and 127 other Medinot, 126 others, there are many people who cannot realize their wishes, or not their own subjective wishes, but even in terms of objective level, standard of living, they can't maintain and sustain that either. That measure of individualism and almost arbitrary will is, of course, symbolized right, what follows right after Askatsunish Vaish. What follows immediately is the Yitzon Yishvayish of Achashverosh. He has his own Yitzon, in this context not related to eating and drinking, although that, of course, is part of the scene, but Lavid Vashtiyah Mokai Vachas Amachut, Lavot Amir Sirbid Yofiaki Tovat Marei. It's immoral in terms of Tzlius. It's unethical in terms of imposing demands upon her against her wishes. She has to respond to Meir Malka Vashti. But first and foremost, it's the arbitrary will of an Oriental despot imposing his will even upon those who are closest to her, presumably, as Vashti Baku presumably is. And this respect sets the tone, in that particular instance, sets the tone for the cultural context of the ethical standards which are present or absent in the Megillah. It was self-will, self-aggrandizement, with the pursuit of pleasure, this is the very hedonistic, the Sibiritic kind of culture, is critical and central. Esther is brought up within that world, but to some extent, of course, insulated from it. She's still young, Mordechai is out to educate her properly, but to be insulated from it in terms of one's own personal education is very different from being insulated from not being with very air, which the whole climate, the whole atmosphere presents. And the kind of world within which she lives, and she's there long enough, presumably, to experience it and to get a feel of what it's all about, it is, I've said, a very selfish kind of world. There's no indication that she absorbed this ethic. But presumably, this was the norm. This was expected. Altruism was certainly not the mode in Achashverosh's country. And when danger lurks, her immediate or natural response is you can't expect her to do anything because of the danger. It's the natural response of A, frightened young girl, B, someone who is accustomed to pursuing the natural bent, to be concerned about yourself, even to neglect what happens to others. The Lech Knosset Kol HaYehudim, when she internalizes Mordechai's message, Mordechai, of course, if the rest of the right word is suspected or assumed, that she would, and this would have been the natural response, feel that she's relatively safe, at least even if she would not feel that way, express it verbally, but that would guide her actions in the natural way. Enough to be Sheva Taisa. Atamina Shobab Kol HaYehudim, the limerit here is not to flee, it's not that. But to find refuge. Lot said in Molton Hashama, it was not flight. It was finding a safe refuge. And that refuge could be found, for her case, passively. So there was nothing corrupt in what Mordechai assumed that she wanted to do. But it was a natural bent. And what follows, and he accused her no more. Achesh lechishi b'yit azot, silence, being passive. You don't have to take action. What is necessary, of course, is not just to overcome to remain inured to the prevalent selfish ethic, to l'aseh t'nish v'ish. That would not suffice. What is necessary is to take the very unnatural step, and the ethical character coming into play against the natural bent, take initiative, which clearly requires some element of danger, but a readiness to set aside one's own personal safety and to prioritize the needs of others. Now, the needs of others, of course, is an understatement. Because you deal here not only with others as individuals, but with the community. danger which confronts those who are in Gilas Baruch HaShverosh is, of course, a dual one. This is central to an appreciation of the story of the Megillah. Each person is personally in danger as a yochid. And the Pashem Tavadat, etc., makes that clear. The individualization of the suffering and the prospective slaughter, minal v'ad zakein in the singular, taf nashim b'yom echad, and there is a collective danger. And what's involved is a sort of genocide for those who are living there. Consequently, the response on her part to transcend the natural egocentric, egotistical characteristics, qualities, and to be concerned beyond her own self, it shows the two planes. One plane, concerned about fellow Jews. Another plane, concerned about Jewry. About the klal. This is emphasized in its pasuk which I quoted previously, as being the critical and crucial turning point in the Megillah. Lech knows that kol yedim nitzim b'shushan, v'tzum olay about the kluv al tishu shu b'ad v'yom, v'ni b'na v'tel tzum keim, kol amat k'shuvat asher lo chadad k'shuvat yavad. This close with Kol HaYehudim is not simply an initiative to gather many Jews as individuals. It's a concern for Yehudim Dar B'chun Nassim, for Knesset Yisrael, for the nation, for the community. And it's an awareness that the road to trying to avert catastrophe, from the communist standpoint, has to do with uprooting the selfish concern, which presumably the Jews there have assimilated, and it was Torah Shachas, I'll say, semi-assimilated Jews were involved in the adoption of the prevalent secular ethic, and replacing that with the sense of Knesset Yisrael, its national identity. Knesset Kol HaYehudim is on her part a transcending of her own selfish priorities, but it's also, I've said, a reconstruction and a reconstitution of the community which now she's out to save. This pasuk, of course, is an antithesis, and there are many parallels in Gilead to what we had in the first parak. The phrase that Yehudim Nitzim B'Shushan appears twice. We got the party. V'vrot yamim b'ayel asem cholam Nitzim B'Shushan v'shal abirah lebigdo v'katzor v'shal shvet yamim chasay ilah b'tah ha'melech. The phrase Nitzim B'Shushan reappears here. But the contrast, of course, is very, very sharp, very striking. First, there's what's done. There, it's a royal feast. They eat themselves under the table. And here, it's v'al tochlu v'tishtu shlo yibeli v'yom. Secondly, there, it's cholam nimtzi b'shushan, presumably an amalgam of people from far and wide, So the capital city, the nature of things normally draws people come from the various provinces. And the final characteristic, the Migadol Vat Katan, is presumably not some ethnic, not some cultural defining factor, but the fact that they're all there, they're within the capital city, and they're there to have a ball, a prolonged inaugural ball. Here, Pasuk speaks not of Chol Ha'am, but Kol HaYehudim. It's in one sense national, in another sense, it is not national within the context of Mahmud Melech Hashverosh. There you've got everybody there, and it's a separate community. Of course, the separateness of that community is emphasized in the Megillah. This is what the Haman complains about, the Temelech Yishno Am Echad, Vuzam Forad, etc., the Temelech in Amosim, the Chuzhvel Anicham. They make this one identity, and particularly as a community, is a central motif. Haman describes them as being an Am Echad, but not existing as a collective community. Mefuzar b'fura b'no amim, a couple here, a couple there, gradually being assimilated as part of the melting pot. And here when the Pasuk speaks, Kelosat Kol HaYehudim, this runs, of course, against the melting pot. It's not Yehudim as part of the Cholam Nimtzim B'Shushan, it's Yehudim Nimtzim B'Shushan Kwa Yehudim. In this respect, of course, the very term Nimtzim B'Shushan assumes a different meaning. Nimtzim B'Shushan, in the first Pasuk, first parak, of course, is simply a description of where they are, what the location is. It's not defined in characteristic, it doesn't speak of any identity. They are there within the mechitzas, within Shushan Abira, that's where they are, and there's little else that binds them. It's like a subway station, subway train. People come from all over, but bonds them and binds them is only the fact that they are together on the train. Contrast with that, in Tzim Shushan, Pelakei, they're not simply located there. They are there around a certain motif. In one respect, it's a response to danger. In another respect, it's a reassertion and a reconstitution of national communal identity. And this is under the leadership of the aegis of Esther. In certain respect, she has, of course, come out of the closet. And my mother has to be in the closet. Don't reveal your identity. And not to reveal your identity there, if this is what Esther did, probably to some extent, this is the prevalent norm. Was it that said, one of the maskilim, Ve'adam etzeitech v'yudi ve'olech, don't flaunt your Jewish identity, keep it in a minor quartet. Let that be within your own private ambience. What you have over here, this gathering, calling Dimnitzim Shushan, every Jew, plus it doesn't describe us how many are there, but it's clear from what follows later on, when they enter battle, how successful they are, there wasn't just a minion or two. All of them are there, putting their identity on the table, putting it up front, reestablishing it, reasserting it, flaunting it. In this respect, there's a growth in Esther's part, not only psychologically, the ability to take the reins, to take charge, and not only morally and ethically, be able to transcend the most fundamental Yetzer Hara. The pasuk speaks of Ki Yetzer Hara Min Urav. Chazal say, what does Min Urav mean? Sheninah Ratzeh B'Meimo. Yetzer Hara is a 13-year head start in the Yetzer Tov. Yetzer Tov is only once a person reaches godless. Yetzer Hara is a meaning. What can Yetzer Hara as an infant have? And even inclinations such, but the Yetzirah is simply egotism. Even a child, an infant of a year, can fight with another infant over who's going to have a toy. And this is the most fundamental, this is Mishanina Mitzvah Meimo, most fundamental of Yetzirah is, and she transcends it. No longer worried solely about herself, willing to endanger herself and give up her own security. Not because she's been convinced that there is no danger. He didn't argue that. He didn't tell her, it'll be all right, he'll give you the Shavit HaSahav, have bitochen. That was not the issue. He said, this is the critical hour, you have a wonderful opportunity, respond, rise to the occasion, do your duty. And she rises and she does it. In that respect, there was a moral growth. But of course, there was a religious and spiritual growth as well. Because to be Kodesh, the Kodesh Yimini Mitzvim B'Shushan, as I mentioned previously, to reaffirm, to reassert the Jewishness, the basic spiritual identity, the heritage, and something that, of course, is made in the Megillah. Mordechai is introduced. This whole lineage is presented. Mordechai ben Yehiya ben Shimi ben Kishi Shemini Shavuot Yerushalayim, etc. On the face of it, it seems pointless. What do you have to know is all Yichus. I said genealogy. But of course the point is that Chazal particularly spoken that after the Golos by Sishin, so there were those who thought they come to Yecheskel, Chazal and Sanhedrin, they said, Ebesh Mechor Abo, does he ever have any responsibility? The master was, the master fed him and housed him and took care of him. So the Ebed had reciprocal responsibilities. But once he's been sold into captivity, or sold at all, the link is no longer there. And whatever the Surah, before the Chum, whatever the Chum, before the Golos, those winds, those currents of thought and opinion certainly were still prevalent. And there is need to explain what it means to be a Yehudi. Mordechai Yehudi, the very term, is one which describes his relationship to Eretz Yehuda. It's not just a geographical, a political relationship, it's a spiritual relationship. And the link, it's not a question of genealogy. Just relate him to Yerushalayim. Relate him to that world, to the world of Eretz Hashem. That's all. So if in order to know that, it's enough to know Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Shemini, Yashar, Yerushalayim, that's sufficient. Beyond that, we don't need to go. So, to be koneis to kol ha-yudim is to be koneis to kwa yudim. It's a reminder. In Jewish time, need to be reminded. Would that they were reminded by more spiritual means, without danger. But Chazal, the Gemara Megillah say that Gedolah Asrat Tabat, the danger which rose with the threat because of Achashverosh giving Haman his ring, more effective than 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'ot. So it was not just an attempt to flee and to surmount the danger, but to cope with it, and to cope with it not by fleeing from one's identity, but reasserting and reaffirming one's identity. This is the effect of Kasoros Tabas. But that effect is one which is not just rise within the community. It requires not just a catalyst, it requires the leader. And Esther becomes, young as she is, certainly maybe still immature as she is, she becomes that leader. So, if we speak in terms of her personal development, there are at least three distinct elements to be borne in mind. One is very indicated the maturity, the psychological capacity, the ability to take initiative, the resourcefulness. Secondly, in moral terms, the transcending of personal goals, personal ambitions, and the readiness to be concerned with others, whether it's others as individuals, others as a community, and the readiness to act in order to try to safeguard those concerns and to say whatever can be saved. Thirdly, there is spiritual and religious revival, the assertion of Jewish identity, and she leads in this respect as well. So we ask ourselves, why the Megillah is called Megillat Esther? There's no indication of anything of this having occurred in relation to anybody else. As I mentioned previously, Mordechai remains pretty much the same Mordechai that he was. Presumably, we don't know very much about him, but in the quarter year at the beginning, a quarter year at the end, a quarter year less prominence, more prominence, so he moves up the political ladder. Before he was just one of the courtiers of the king's Achashverosh's environs, and then he's towards the end of Mishnah Lamar Achashverosh. This is not a transmutation, neither in personal nor spiritual terms. He starts the Mordechai Yehudi, he ends the Mordechai Yehudi. He has the link to tradition behind him, how he managed to walk between the raindrops in the simulationist environment of Shushan, it's not clear, but there's no indication of any significant movement or development with regard to himself, either as far as his personal self is concerned, or even as far as his role is concerned. With regard to Esther, that of course does occur. As I've indicated, at various planes. So in this respect, it's the story of Esther personally. But it is another respect, of course, her story, the story of Zeir Anpin, of how the Megillah should be read, in terms of what happens, not only to her personally, but to the community. There's a little which is overt in the Megillah about a kind of spiritual religious revival. Shem Shemayim doesn't appear in the Megillah at all. Koyd Melachim Aster Dabar, Esther Tel Binayin, Chazaz Vechester, Esther Panami, Vayimahu. Everything is submerged. But Chazal in particular read the Megillah not simply as a story which is cyclical, at the end of which you come back to the point of departure. They read it as a helix. There is a certain cycle, but you end as one who is exposed to danger needs to end on a higher note than you had begun. Read very superficially, one could say, well, here you have the story of danger, And now they got away from the danger, and then they went back to where they were at the beginning. As if someone was sick, and then he recovers, and he goes back to what he had been before. This is not the Mechazal of the Megillah. And for anyone, whether an individual or community is religiously sensitive, it cannot be read that way. And if that's all that happens, then one has missed the opportunity which the kind of danger and challenge presented, which needs to be taken. And if we ask ourselves what presumably happens to Klal Yisrael in the course of the Megillah, that what happens is to them parallels and mirrors what happens to Esther. At one level, there are new capacities, new kochot, which come to the fore. It's indicated it's not clear what happens to them, where they stand at the beginning. But the pictures Homer portrays, without Palabin or Amin, does not give a sense of strength, of solidarity, but quasi-assimilationist tendencies, even though paradoxically it's within a pasuk where he speaks, they don't assimilate, but at the time of Chanan Mosim, they don't assimilate, as he doesn't assimilate, and he doesn't want to bow down. But at the bottom, you don't have a sense of a vibrant apostolic community, thriving, powerful, resourceful, creative. They seem to be pretty much accommodating the prevalent culture. It's this that Chazal intended when they speak of the enemies of the Dosh Lator Rasha, and that's why they were threatened with extinction, says the Gemara. It's not a question of the Oivon of Elis Atreifis, whether they were going to eat the Tziyai Nesach. That's not the issue. The issue is the loss of identity, the loss of independence, and the gradual erosion, if not erasure, of the distinctive nature of Klal Yisrael and Am Levadad Yishkol. They're part of the Meiros Kvishev Medina. Now that is in and of itself, without getting involved for the moment, the specific Jewish side, a weakness. An ethnic community, to the extent that gradually assimilates, loses its inner vibrancy, its inner strength, loses its own character. The resurgence which you have towards the end is a rebirth in terms of the inner strength, the inner power of the community. It's reflected at one plane in the military side. But the military side is a one-time thing. And to see what the impact of the Megillah is, the whole episode is, one needs to think beyond that particular year, those few days, and the impact upon permanence. And this is stressed in the Megillah. By Yemim Ba'ila, Yisrim and Asim, Chodo, Chodo, Mishpacha, Mishpacha, Medina, Medina, Be'ir, Va'ir, mentioned before, the Rambam, even when other Nevi'im, other Sifrei Nevi'im will fade, this will remain. It's a determination. Kimu v'kimlu, etc. Now, quite apart from the specific content and where they stand with regard to halachic observance and the like, there is communal strength, there is a certain fiber here which we've been missing before. And of course, the contrast to earlier psukim, Dinam Dinavi Avail, regardless of where they'll be, that sense of their own identity, defined, expressed in a smaller context, in a broader context, within the nuclear family, within the broader community. This is a kind of a social, psychological revival. Secondly, Knesset Kol HaYehudim, which I spoke previously, the transcending of egotism and egocentrism, and the sharpening of the sense of community, of self-sacrifice, of concern for others, empathy, all of that stands in sharp contrast to Lasut Tzon Ish V'Ish. To the extent that there is a Ratzon of Ish V'Ish, it's not a Ratzon to drink this or to eat that, it's a Ratzon to see oneself as part of a community which is vibrant, which is growing, which is committed, which has a sense of purpose, which has a past and has a history, and has a future. But of course, important as these two would be, Chazal focused on the religious side, the spiritual side as well. This is partly reflected, of course, in what you have in Chazal with regard to the story of the Megillah, some details of halachas, some discussions which have entered the world of Talmud Torah, Esther Faresia, none of the halachas of Megillah, other halachas as well. But first and foremost, in the sense of renewed dedication and commitment. Kibum kibra yudi, kibum shikiblu kva. This phrase, kibum shikiblu kva, appears in Chazal in two different contexts and two different meanings. One is Gemara Shavuos, and the other Gemara in Megillah, and the Gemara Shabbos. I'm sorry. Gemara Shabbos says that. Well, let me start with the Gemara Shavuos. Gemara Shavuos speaks of Kabbalah Satera. Says that when the Kabbalah is not in specific mitzvah, specific content which is given to them in the Ma'amid of Sinai, but they wrote a blank check to the Ben Shleima. Minayin ve'ed le mitzvah shekiblu alehem me'ar Sinai mitzvah tadod yitchadesh k'o mikra megillah minayin temolo kibu v'shekiblu kvar. That was where the Gemara interprets over there, that when there was a reaffirmation at the conclusion of Megillah, Kimu Kibra Yudim, Kimu Kiblu, that which they had already assumed and undertaken, to which they had already become committed, the Ma'amid of Sinai, which involved not only accepting certain specific norms, certain specific mores, but acknowledging the authority of the Ben Shleila, and that, as I've said, entails writing a blank check. Well, Shabbos, on this reading, as the Shavuos would have it, there's no new level attained at the end of the Megillah which had not existed previously. At most, they reaffirm that which had already been affirmed at Sinai. Well, Shabbos, of course, then stands differently. But says that one could have complained about that moment at Sinai. It was an element of coercion, was under pressure. They didn't have absolute free will, given the circumstances, the overwhelming Gilui Shechina, where one really could not choose freely. Modor Abba L'Araisa, one could therefore challenge the validity of that Kabbalah Satera. Then he must hold the Kabbalah B'Merach HaShveirosh, Kimu v'kiblu kvar, Then Torah was accepted willingly, voluntarily, under the impact of any impending danger or impending threat. What Chazal intended to communicate there, of course, is that not only was the conclusion of the Megillah simply the removal of a danger, and then you go back to Shmiras parties. Beyond that, it was not even a return in spiritual terms to where they had been before they lapsed, before they began to assimilate, which would involve the return to perhaps the level of Shmiras HaMitzvah, the level of commitment, which they had at the end of Bais Rishon, going back to Shalom Yerushalayim, and that would be about it. Chazal understood that where there was such a crisis, one is challenged and one is rejuvenated and attains a higher level than existed previously, not only with God to himself, but in general, as a result of this crisis. In this respect, Chazal see Megillas Esther as kind of a turning point in Jewish history. Not only broader historical terms, but in spiritual religious terms, halakhic terms, even more narrowly defined. As Esther had her own maturing experience in the confrontation with danger, Klal Yisrael too encountered danger, the danger of extinction, confronted it at one level pragmatically, practically, paralleling to what Esther had done. She approached the Malach, she'll do this, she'll do that. They, for their part, when they need to fight, they fight, they need to organize, they organize. But that is paralleled by an upsurge and a deepening and intensification of religious and spiritual commitment and sharpening the sense of their own, of their own personal and collective identity. So in this respect, one can speak of Megillat Esther as being a very personal tale. In other respect, as being a very national tale. What happens to her as Bizeh Anpi is what happens to Klal Yisrael, partly those who are Nimtzim B'Shushan, but partly the Gemara Shabbos beyond that. There is the sense of self growing and developing. There is the moral transformation in terms of overcoming the self-centered, egotistical, natural state and reaching out and reaching beyond, not only to the others as an individual, but to the sense of community as such. And there is a recommitment to Havedis Hashem, to Havedis Shalom, as a result of the confrontation with danger and the sense of perspective which that gives, and the sense of gratitude which that entails for the source of their salvation and their geula. All of that, of course, is part of what we take note of on Purim, and part of what we take note of in Kiryas HaMegillah. Kiryas HaMegillah, in one respect, of course, is the narrative of but also Kiryas HaMegillah. So Menisa has to do with our relationship to the Ben Shleilam and his relationship to us. It has to do also, though, not only what he did for us, but what we, in a sense, did for ourselves. And the narrative of the Megillah is not just a fascinating agreement one per se, but as an expression of the higher level of spiritual entity which we've attained through the events narrated within it. So it's Megillat Esther, and it's a Megillat of Kol HaYehudim, which he was mechanes.
It's not dead.
I'll tell you, the recording is good.
Depends on which you finish.